stepping over rock and thorn in thin sandals, going without food or water, a bandolier of ammunition slung over his shoulder, two grenades stuffed in a bag at his waist, to reach this place of war, the desolate village of Chichke. With Massoud rumored dead, they would finish off what was left of the corrupt enemies of Islam. Abdul was a member of bin Laden's crack unit called the 055 Brigade, part of the larger Al-Qaeda army. He had met the great man a month earlier near Kandahar, the birthplace of the Taliban and their spiritual home of study. The word Talib is Arabic for student. The training camp, Al-Farouk, was frequented by Saudis, by Chechens and Pakistanis, the very best of the most serious martyrs drawn to the searing light of bin Laden's message. Some of the camp followers had achieved martyrdom in the previous several years by bombing embassies in Nairobi and Saudi Arabia, even an American warship named the USS Cole in Yemen. These righteous attacks had killed many people, Americans among them. His comrades, Abdul knew, had died in order to drive the dirty infidel, the Jew, the Christian, the Buddhist, the atheist, from the land of Muhammad, which was Saudi Arabia, the hard rock cradle of Islam, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. After the bombing of the USS Cole, which killed 17 sailors and injured 39 more, Abdul had emailed his mother and father in California that the ship's presence in the Yemeni's harbor had been an act of war. Abdul's father was deeply disappointed that his son felt this way, but he also knew that there was nothing he could do to change his mind. He felt that his son was long past the point of being influenced by a father's opinions. Bin Laden had made it clear in his fatwas, his edicts, that it was an insult for the infidel to have based his soldiers in Muhammad's land after the first Gulf War, what the Americans called Desert Storm. As a result, every American, bin Laden claimed, must be killed wherever he was found. Abdul Hamid knew that bin Laden dreamed of an ancient world of Islam coming back to life. Violent jihad would be his time machine. Abdul Hamid had come to Afghanistan 11 months earlier to help the Taliban in his fight. At Al-Farouk, soldiers in training were taught to shoot a rifle, throw a grenade, use a compass, and poison water, food, and people. Abdul had heard bin Laden speak at the camp. One of the men at Al-Farouk had approached Abdul and asked if he wanted to carry the struggle to Israel or the United States. It would be easier for him to serve as a sleeper agent in such places than it would a dark-skinned Saudi or Pakistani. Part of Abdul Hamid was still a boy from Marin County, a young man who had sold his CD collection of rap music to pay for his ticket to the land of jihad. Part of him still wanted to go home and see his father, a lawyer, who had named him after John Lennon, and his mother, who had homeschooled him and loved him when other kids made fun of him. What he heard today, though, troubled him. There had been an attack, a big one, in the United States. Martyrs had flown jet airplanes into some buildings. They had killed thousands and thousands of Americans. He had told the bearded man no. His fight was here, in Afghanistan, with the Taliban. He did not want to kill Americans. The tiny speakers of the Motorola radios in the trenches around Abdul squawked the news. The world in flames. America tumbling down. Major Mark Mitchell walked into the packed mess hall at Fort Campbell just as the first scenes of the attack were playing out on a TV mounted in the big room. Mitchell nearly dropped his fork as the news sunk in. There were about 75 guys inside, and they'd fallen silent as they stared at the monitor. Mitchell had just come from morning physical training out on the parade field, playing ultimate frisbee with the man in the support company. He was standing there holding his mess tray with an omelet, biscuit, and salsa on top, when he heard the reporter on TV explain that a Cessna, or some kind of other small plane, had flown into the World Trade Center. "That was not a Cessna," Mitchell said. "And no commercial pilot in the world would fly into a building. He'd be ditching in the Hudson River." Some of the younger guys at one of the tables started snickering, announcing that the footage had to be a prank. "It's a clear, blue sky day," Mitchell went on. "There's not a cloud in the sky." "It's an accident," somebody else said. Mitchell turned and shouted, "Shut up! This is not a joke! This is not a laughing matter!" The depth of emotion startled even him. The younger soldiers shut up. Seconds later, the second plane hit. Mitchell hurried out the door and across the parking lot, under the scraggly oak trees, across the burnt grass, and up the concrete steps to his office. As the operations officer for 3rd Battalion, 5th Special Forces Group, it was Mitchell's job to help make sure that the group was ready to mobilize to anywhere in the world within 96 hours. The group's main theater of operations was the Middle East, under the command of Central Command, CENTCOM, and General Tommy Franks, down at Tampa at MacDill Air Force Base, and he knew the folks in Florida would already be making plans. When Mitchell turned down the hall, he saw his fellow staff officers standing around looking stunned. He could tell already that everybody was running on all cylinders, but with nowhere to go. He wondered what they'd look like by the end of the day. Mitchell found another group of them standing around a TV in the conference room upstairs, watching the towers burn. A staff officer walked up and told him the Pentagon had just been hit. Mitchell couldn't believe it. The towers had been a matched pair, but the attack on the Pentagon, in a different city, nearly simultaneously. This raised the game to a different level. By the time Greg Gibson, a helicopter pilot, passed through the guard gate at the 160th SOAR headquarters, he had heard enough on the radio to realize the crash was not an accident. Walking into the hangar, he told his crew to get ready to break down the Black Hawks and twin-rotored Chinooks for travel. Gibson knew they were going to war. Mitchell rushed back down the stairs to his boss's office, 3rd Battalion Commander Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers, to update him on what he knew. Bowers had been at home finishing a shower when he heard news of the attacks delivered by his 5-year-old son standing in the bathroom. "Dad," the young boy said, "a plane just flew into a big building in New York. Really?" His son had been watching TV in another part of the house, and Bowers hadn't heard any of the reports. Bowers, wrapped in a towel, smiled, ruffled his son's hair, and told him not to joke about something like that. Then he hurried to get dressed for work. On the way, he turned on the radio in the car. Bowers's short salt-and-pepper hair was still wet from the shower as he gravely listened to Mitchell report the strike on the Pentagon. Mitchell could tell Bowers was upset, and he knew Bowers was not one to scare easily. A powerfully built 42-year-old career officer, he was smart and articulate. In Bosnia, in 1999, Bowers had snuck into the war-torn country by commercial flight, a risky move in contravention of U.S. policy at the time. Congress would eventually authorize U.S. troops on the ground. Once there, Bowers had called back to Fort Bragg on a payphone at the airport to say, "I'm in," and then hung up. He proceeded to help guide the air war by spotting targets from the ground. The mission was a success. Nobody had gotten hurt but the bad guys. Instead of a demotion, upon his return, Bowers was secretly applauded. Bowers told Mitchell that there were reports coming in from the Department of Defense in Washington on the red side, classified email, and that for the moment, the plan was, There was no plan. Mitchell hurriedly left Bowers's office to call Maggie. "Where are you?" he demanded. "I'm driving," said Maggie. "I've left the post." "Get back here, now." She could tell Mark was worried, and that had her worried. Maggie, a mother of two, had left to do some errands at Target in the mall. She'd left their older girl, age 3, with a nanny, and had taken the younger, age 2, with her.
"Did you hear what happened?" Mark asked.
"Oh, Mark, I was listening to the radio."
"You need to get home and get in the house."
Without further thought, she wheeled the Ford Explorer around and headed back in the other lane. It was 9:30 in the morning. Because security had been tightened at Fort Campbell, each car was now painstakingly searched at the front gate. Normally, Maggie would have been able to flash her driver's license at an armed soldier at the gate and drive on. Traffic was now backed up for at least a mile on Highway 41A, all the way from a place called Show West, a strip club, to the Army Surplus Store and pawn shops outside Gate 4, the post's main entrance. There were nearly 4,000 families living on base, and it seemed every one of them was trying to get back home. Cal Spencer and his team got back from the Cumberland River around mid-morning, then promptly ran smack into the same traffic jam that had snarled Maggie Mitchell. Sam Diller got out of the truck, stood bow-legged in the middle of the road, and looked up and down the long line of cars coming and going from the fort. The snarl was particularly bad because of a concrete barrier cutting off a lane.
"We can get through," said Sam. "We just need to move one of these barricades."
Spencer agreed. He and Sam and a couple other guys in the teams bent down and heaved-ho.
"I don't think you should be doing that," said an approaching guard from the 101st Airborne, the regular army.
He had an M16 slung across his chest. He looked scared by the morning's events. Guys like Spencer and Sam had spent their special forces careers avoiding the regular army. And now here was this kid, afraid to break the rules when it made sense to break them. They ignored him and kept grunting until the cement divider was moved. Spencer ran back to the truck, drove it through, and then helped the others push the big chunk back into place. Then they sped past the Fort Campbell Bank, the PX, the Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Taco Bell, to 3rd Battalion Headquarters. Spencer felt he was seeing all of these ordinary sights for the very first time. As the morning wore on, from his office at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, Major General Jeffrey Lambert was working the odds. The son of Kansas Mennonite farmers, Lambert, at 54, was the commanding general of United States Army Special Forces Command, USASFC, which was composed of 9,500 men spread across the world in different geographic zones. 5th Group ran the Middle East and Africa. 7th and 3rd Groups, based at Bragg, operated in Latin America, interdicting narco-traffickers and insurgencies. 10th Group was based in Colorado and operated in Europe. Lieutenant Colonel Bowers had been part of the 10th Group when he went into Kosovo. The Pacific Rim, Indonesia, and the Philippines fell under 1st Group's oversight, based in Fort Lewis, Washington. The other groups, 19th and 20th, which were made up of National Guard soldiers, went wherever they were needed. These groups formed a wide net, cast by highly secretive men. Lambert knew that 5th Group's bell had just been rung. It had taken him about 10 seconds to figure out who had masterminded the attacks and who had carried them out. For the past several years, he had observed a top-secret intelligence program called data mining that had identified one man, an Egyptian by the name of Mohammed Atta, as a serious terrorist with links to a Saudi named Bin Laden, who was a financier of terrorist training camps for men like the Egyptian.
Months earlier, the people involved in the program had tried telling the FBI what they had discovered. But Army lawyers had discouraged the disclosure, even though the project had identified the hijackers. Lambert figured they knew everything there was to know about Osama bin Laden and his military training camps in Afghanistan. But none of the legal minds could decide if the surveillance was lawful. Now Lambert felt sick that more effort had not been made to warn someone. Lambert, extremely upset, later agreed with lawyers that the information not be shared with the FBI. Usually there was a contingency plan on the shelf at the Department of Defense for invading a country. But when it came to Afghanistan, Lambert knew that no such plan existed. Nothing. Not one scrap of paper describing how you mobilized men and weapons to take down the place. Since the end of the Cold War, U.S. military planners had been floundering in the backwash of old conflicts, unsure of how to prepare for imagined threats from unfamiliar enemies. The attacks were, to Lambert's mind, perfect examples of the kind of violence that the future held for Americans. They had come quickly and cheaply, carried out by a small number of men, communicating by mobile phones and the Internet. The damage had equaled that which might have been achieved by an entire army. Yet it had cost only $500,000 to inflict. Small change, all things considered. Lambert had been a hard-charging U.S. Army Ranger, serving 10 years in the jungles of Latin America, fighting all kinds of insurgencies, great and small, secret and public, when he'd left to become a Special Forces officer. Being a Ranger, he said, was a fine thing, but being an SF was a lot finer. Lambert was resolved to get his guys in this new fight, though he figured that General Tommy Franks, the CENTCOM commander, would never consider them a viable option. Franks didn't understand Special Forces soldiers, nor did he really like them. Few officers in the big regular army were fond of this secretive branch of independent-minded warriors. Over the past several years, funding for Special Forces had been cut, and few people outside the community realized that many of the teams lacked the equipment they needed. Hell, a lot of the teams didn't have a full contingent of men. Short a medic here, a weapon specialist there. Vietnam had done them in. During that war, the men of 5th Group grew their hair, slept in hammocks, took native women as girlfriends, and lived and fought in the jungle far beyond the reach of anyone's official control. They had also committed some of the conflict's worst atrocities. In the late 1980s, the unit was shunted into deeper twilight, providing what was called FID, or Foreign Internal Defense, a euphemism for training the armies of foreign governments. Other missions, such as serving as policemen on Native American reservations, had been more routine. Desert Storm had provided the first use of Special Forces in combat since Vietnam, much to the initial chagrin of General Norman Schwarzkopf, who'd seen their dirty work while commanding in Southeast Asia. The SF guys weren't particularly happy with their assignment. Hunting scud sites was, they figured, the kind of soldiering better suited to gung-ho Marines, the publicity-savvy Navy SEALs, or the Army's secretive counterterrorism unit, Delta Force. They were masters at the snatch-and-grab, door-kicking, Lambert called it. Let these other troops handle hardware hunts and scavenger forays. Special Forces trained to do something different from everyone else. They fought guerrilla wars. This fighting was divided into phases: combat, diplomacy, and nation-building. They were trained to make war and provide humanitarian aid after the body count. They were both soldier and diplomat. The medics worked as dentists, fixing the teeth of local villagers. The engineers, experts at the orchestrated mayhem of explosives and demolition, were trained to rebuild a village's bridges and government offices. They spoke the locals' language and assiduously studied their customs concerning religion, sex, health, and politics. Their minds lived in the dark corners of the world. Often, they were the senior-ranking American officials in a country, hunkered down in the dirt, drawing out a water treatment plan with some warlord, and acting as America's de facto State Department. The SEALs and the regular army generally studied none of a country's languages, customs, or nuances. Special forces thought first and shot last. They were the Velvet Hammer. Lambert knew that in the history of the United States, Special Forces soldiers had never been given the chance to fight as a lead element. To get them off the bench and on the field was going to take considerable back-channel maneuvering. The U.S. Army had zero interest in deploying a bunch of cowboys in Afghanistan, who had served as inspiration for the best scenes in Apocalypse Now. Lambert was banking on the cooperation of the CIA and its covert ties in the country. During the 1979-89 Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the agency had funded the Mujahideen, freedom fighters. Of all the diplomatic and military branches of the U.S. government, the CIA had kept the closest watch on Afghanistan. It was the go-to authority. It was also the progenitor of U.S. Special Forces. After World War II, the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, had disbanded, and its members migrated into either what eventually became the Central Intelligence Agency, or into Special Forces. The unit itself wasn't officially formed until 1952, as the first Special Forces Group, adopting a red arrowhead with a dagger down the middle as its emblem. The symbol was not a haphazard choice. The World War II Army soldiers who had fought as guerrillas had drawn their inspiration from the Apache scouts of the 19th century. They had survived behind German and Japanese lines by relying on the goodwill of the friendly people they encountered. Often outgunned and outnumbered, they ambushed instead of employing frontal assaults. They harassed supply trains. They attacked in several places at once and vanished into the woods. They followed none of the regular rules of warfare. Relishing their lethal craft of stealth and surprise, these World War II soldiers even nicknamed themselves the Devil's Brigade, sneaking into German trenches in the night and slitting the throats of a surprised enemy. Daylight would reveal a chilling scene: paper arrowheads left on the foreheads of the dead men. Earlier in the American Revolution, this homegrown brand of war had been practiced by Ethan Allen in the northeastern states, and Francis Marion, a.k.a. the Swamp Fox, in the south. A particularly rough group of marauders named Rogers Rangers had terrified the British with their lightning raids. The credo of the band was simple: let the enemy come till he's almost close enough to touch. Then let him have it, and jump out and finish him up with your hatchet. Lambert relished the prospect that his soldiers would be called to fight this kind of war. He was also worried. The men were untested. Once he launched them, quick rescue would be impossible. By midday, when Mitchell checked with Bowers, there still was no plan. The order stayed the same: be ready to leave at a moment's notice. As Mitchell walked the halls, he heard the crackle and burble of the same news playing on the radios and TVs. Each minute seemed trapped in the endless looping of one moment: the towers falling, the towers falling. By late afternoon, the day felt like it had lasted for a year. When it was clear nothing more was going to happen, that no plan for action was forthcoming from Washington, Mitchell decided to go home. He pulled into his driveway well after dark, staring at the lights burning in the windows of his trim brick ranch house. He and Maggie lived in a far corner of Fort Campbell, in a place called Werner Park, that was filled with deer, bordered by woods, and populated by officers and their wives. The day before, September 10, he had returned from a trip out west. 10 days in a rental car, spent pulling into ranchers' driveways, asking whether the U.S. Army could use their property for a war game. A game. He shook his head at how much had changed in one morning. Mitchell got out and walked across the lawn, flipping and reflipping the interior switch that all men reach for who are not violent, but who live in a violent world. Warrior, father. Warrior, father. Father. He pushed open the door and kissed Maggie. "I will do anything to protect this place," he thought. Cal Spencer arrived home at the end of the day in his ratty second-hand Mercedes and swept Marcia up in a hug when he walked through the door. "I can't believe it," he said quietly. She felt him tense as he said this. She stepped back and looked at him. "You're going away," she said. He nodded. "Yeah." "When?" "I have no idea." Marcia knew that soon Cal would walk around the house looking for things that usually he had no trouble finding, like his life insurance policy. He'd grow short-tempered, and he'd talk about what would happen to her and the boys if he didn't come home, if he got killed on this deployment. She never liked having this conversation, and her refusal always led to a fight, usually a bad one. Cal kissed her and went into the garage and started packing, pulling stuff off of the metal storage shelves, his sleeping bag, his camelback for drinking water, his headlamp. He was worried how their sons were going to take the day's attack. Their oldest was living in Mississippi and working at a job he liked. He was going to be fine. Luke, the middle child and a high school junior, kept his feelings inside, like Cal did. Jake, the youngest, a sophomore, was easygoing. He wanted to be an actor or a comedian. Cal and Marcia worried about him the least. So when Jake walked through the door after school, and Cal saw the quizzical, sad look on his face, he knew that this leave-taking was going to be hard. He knew that Jake had spent the day at school hearing about the attacks in New York, and that he'd imagined the worst for his dad. "Are you leaving, Dad?" "Yeah, I am." Jake nodded and kept walking down the hall to his room. Cal started to follow him, but stopped. He'd leave him alone for now. He imagined Jake in his room in front of his Nintendo. He was pretty sure he wouldn't be playing a war game, where your bullets rarely ran out, and a wound to the chest was just a momentary inconvenience. The boy had had enough of war, with his dad gone almost half his life. How in the world, Cal wondered, can a man love his family and want to go to war at the same time? President George W. Bush appeared on TV the next day, September 12, and declared war on Al-Qaeda. Over the next 24 hours, a military response began to emerge. Tommy Franks proposed to Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and President Bush that America invade Afghanistan with 60,000 troops. He explained that such a massive migration would take 6 months. Donald Rumsfeld hated the plan. "I want men on the ground now," he said. In response, CIA Director George Tenet proposed sending in CIA operators with Special Forces soldiers. At Special Operations Command, this alternate plan was refined and sent back up the chain to Rumsfeld. At Fort Campbell, Mitchell and Spencer followed the developments closely, in the news and in the battalion hallways. Dean, still in his hotel in Tahiti, felt cut off. He was spending a good part of each day on the phone, trying to book a flight back to the States. On September 14, he and Kelly finally arrived back in Clarksville. When he took her to a team picnic to meet everyone, his battalion commander walked up and shook her hand and said, "Welcome to Special Forces. Your husband will be leaving soon." Several days later, for the first time in American history, President Bush approved a plan using Special Forces as the lead element in the war in Afghanistan. The plan involved using massive American air power, cruise missiles, and laser-guided bombs to blast the Taliban out of the country. U.S. Special Forces on the ground would spot targets, build alliances among the locals, and whip them into fighting shape. The Afghan Northern Alliance, Massoud's old fighting force of several tribes led by different warlords, would make up the bulk of the ground power. The CIA would grease the wheels, many of them unturned in years, with money and intel, and help the SF soldiers link up with the Afghans. General Franks had spent part of the week holed up in a room at the Sheraton Hotel in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, convincing the country's president to let the United States base its troops in the former Soviet Republic. Beset by Islamic terrorists of their own called the IMU, the Uzbekis had not been an easy sell, but Franks had succeeded. On September 18, to a packed White House cabinet room, President Bush announced, "The war starts today." Naturally, the plan was classified, top secret. Mitchell, Spencer, and Dean started arriving at work at 4 a.m. and stayed until midnight. Birthday parties, anniversaries, normal life were canceled. Nothing mattered except the war, getting ready for the war, planning to survive the war, and coming home alive. All the men believed 5th Group could be deployed at any hour. Nobody went anywhere, the mall, the dentist, the movies, without leaving a cell phone number with the staff person in charge. Teams went to the firing range and shot thousands of rounds of ammo at pop-up targets. They practiced patrolling, ambushes, winter survival techniques. They marched, lifted weights, and in the absence of real intel, they were told CIA analysts at Langley were working on it, read anything they could find about Afghanistan on the internet. They cleaned weapons, took inventory of broken equipment, and made lists of the necessary gear. They needed a lot, so much so that it was embarrassing. Their group commander, 45-year-old Colonel John Mulholland, had taken charge of the soldiers just 2 months earlier, after a staff posting in Washington, D.C., and a stint as a student at the National War College. He was working around the clock to meet the needs of his men. Tall, massively built, with the intense, pinched gaze of someone who did not suffer fools, Mulholland had served during the 1980s under General Lambert as a Special Forces lieutenant in Latin America, and he'd worked as a Delta Force operator in the mid-1990s. He assured each team that they could have whatever new equipment they needed. After much cajoling and pressuring on his part and Lambert's, the Pentagon had agreed to pull out the golden credit card. There was no time to requisition supplies the old-fashioned way, so new methods were created. Sergeant Dave Betts and his staff called camping stores like REI and Campmore and bought all the socks and tents they had on the shelves, literally everything in stock. Same with the clothes. And when the dealers ran out, as they did with a particular black fleece jacket everyone wanted, the guys called North Face headquarters and bought direct. There were soldiers perusing back issues of Shotgun News magazine and ordering pistol holsters and ammo magazines for AK-47s. They bought Camelback water hydration systems, thermoses, water filters, tan winter boots made by a company called Rockies, duffel bags, Iridium satellite phones, generators, toolkits, compressors, electric conversion kits to convert 12-volt DC to 110-volt AC, camp stoves, fuel, and headlamps. Staff guys carried new radios and laptops and PDAs into team rooms, gizmos the men had never seen before. The guys liked the lightweight Garmin eTrex GPSs, the military GPS being heavy and the size of a writing tablet, and couldn't purchase enough, ordering them all over the country, 300 to 400 at a time. A supply sergeant would email a supplier, "I want all your GPSs, hold them." And they bought batteries. One of Betz's men personally drove over to an enormous store near Fort Campbell called Batteries Plus, bought every AA they had, and drove off with them in the trunk of his car. As he departed, the sales clerk stared slack-jawed at their empty racks. Everything not in car trunks and back seats was shipped overnight by FedEx. The delivery trucks pulling up to a gray two-story building that resembled a grain elevator, balanced atop a warehouse. The place was called the Isolation Facility, or ISOFAC. There, the equipment was stacked along walls on aluminum pallets, palletized, and each bunch was covered with a waterproof material nicknamed an elephant rubber. The covering was meant to protect the gear during the long plane journey to a place called Karshi Khanabad in Uzbekistan, a staging base, also top secret. Everybody called it K2. On September 18, Lieutenant Colonel Bowers announced, "I need a man for a secret mission." Stepping forward was a seasoned master sergeant from New Hampshire named John Bolduc, nicknamed the Skeletor, after the He-Man comic book superhero. Shy, quiet, thin as a whip, Bolduc held the record for finishing a grueling 18-mile rucksack march required to pass Special Forces selection in just 3 hours. It took most people 8 to cover the distance. At the time, Bolduc had actually had to wake up the guys in the lead van. They hadn't expected anybody to show up until dawn. They thought Bolduc was kidding when he told them he was done. Bolduc was not a kidder. At Fort Campbell, the Master Sergeant's men would follow him anywhere, even off the edge. He would emerge from the woods during the team's fun runs, sprint off a high rock ledge, and drop 50 feet to the quarry water below, still pedaling in the air, looking over his shoulder to make sure his team was following him. If they were, he knew he was doing a good job. The irony, given his dedication, was that Bolduc had recently put in for retirement after 18 years in the Army. In fact, he'd received some of the official paperwork on September 11. His fellow soldiers tried to talk him out of leaving, but he would have none of it. "I only have one reason for retiring," he told them then. "I have a teenage daughter who doesn't know me, and I don't know her." Bolduc had added up the years to discover he'd spent half of his daughter's life away from home, deployed to godforsaken snatches of sand, winning, but losing too. Still, he was torn. He'd jumped into Panama as a ranger in the takedown of Noriega. But this was the big time. As a soldier, you lived for wars like this. As he stood before Bowers' desk, the battalion commander asked Bolduc, "Are you retired yet?" "No, sir, not yet." For once, the Army's glacial pace of dealing with paperwork had opened the door instead of closing it. "Are you ready for a mission?" "I am." "I can't tell you where you're going, but plan as if you're going into combat." "When do I leave?" "Tonight." Several hours later, Bolduc was standing on the airstrip at Fort Campbell, clutching a rucksack loaded with Claymore mines, hand grenades, radios, and ammo magazines. Most intriguing was the getup he'd been instructed to wear during the mission. The disguise, consisting of paisley bell-bottom pants, a blue nylon shirt, and a funky slouch hat, was designed to make him look like an American hipster on parade in a former satellite of the Soviet Union. But after trying on the clothes, he decided that what he really looked like was a 70s porn star, and he stashed the duds in a closet at home. He now stood nervously on the tarmac in Levi's, flannel shirt, and hiking boots, waiting for his adventure to begin. A white Citation jet with no tail numbers swooped down out of the sky, rolled to a quick stop, and picked him up. 24 hours later, Bolduc was in Uzbekistan, at K2, a desolate piece of real estate oozing chemical waste, misery, and the rank bloom of failure. The Russians had used the place to stage their failed 10-year war in Afghanistan, against the likes of Massoud and his men, the fabled Mujahideen fighters. The Russians had gotten their heads handed to them, losing 50,000 men in the war. Historians credited their defeat as one of the causes of the collapse of the Soviet Union, one final and fatal proxy battle between the United States and the USSR in the Cold War. Bolduc's job was to help redesign this flat, muddy ground as the new secret home for a group of soldiers determined not to repeat the Soviets' mistakes, a place from which the entire fury of America's military could be unleashed on the Taliban. Bolduc had never done anything like this in his life. He wasn't an engineer, but he fully intended to try. This was the Special Forces way. You improvised like mad. The CIA was doing its part, too. On September 19, paramilitary officer Gary Schroen loaded 3 cardboard boxes, each packed with $3 million in $100 bills, into an unmarked Suburban, and headed off to see his boss, Kofor Black, at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. The money was meant to bribe the Afghan warlords that the Special Forces troops were to work with. Rough, mercurial characters with names like Abdul Rashid Dostum, Atta Mohammed Noor, and Mohammed Mohakik. For the past decade or more, they had fought each other for control of their country. Schroen would be flying to Afghanistan with the money that day, aiming to convince them to work together to kick the Taliban's ass. He was doubtful of the outcome. You can't buy an Afghan's loyalty, he thought, but you can sure try to rent it. Kofor Black was very specific about another aspect of Schroen's mission. Writing later about the conversation, Schroen would recount Black saying, "I have discussed this with the president," he said, "and he is in full agreement. You are to convince the Northern Alliance to work with us to accept U.S. military forces. But beyond that, your mission is to exert all efforts to find Osama bin Laden and his senior lieutenants, and to kill them." "I don't want bin Laden and his thugs captured," Black explained. "I want them dead. Alive and in prison, here in the United States, they'll become a symbol, a rallying point for other terrorists." And then Black shocked Schroen. "I want to see photos of their heads on pikes. I want bin Laden's head shipped in a box filled with dry ice. I want to be able to show bin Laden's head to the president. I promised him I would do that. Have I made myself clear?" Schroen believed that he understood the mission. The following day, Cal Spencer got the call. As the CIA built up alliances with different Afghan tribes, the Air Force would conduct its air war. Spencer's team, the Pentagon had decided, would provide combat search and rescue, CSAR, for bomber pilots who'd been shot down by the Taliban. During the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, The United States had supplied Stinger missiles to the anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighters. After the Soviets' retreat, the Taliban had emerged from the ranks of these highly trained soldiers. The United States had turned a blind eye to the radical religious beliefs of some of its favored Mujahideen, and now it would pay the price. The extremists had become terrorists, anxious to use the Stinger missiles against U.S. soldiers. CSAR was a heady mission, and Spencer had spent years training for it as a young sergeant at Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. He and his team would be working behind enemy lines on a thin wire of support. If anything went wrong, they were on their own. They welcomed the challenge, but there was one problem. Their team didn't have a captain. A week earlier, Captain Mitch Nelson had been kicked upstairs to 5th Group headquarters, promoted out of the job he loved, following the team's return from a training mission. Nelson, 32, the son of a Kansas rancher, was miserable in his new staff position. He hated office work, but if he expected to move up in rank, he had to punch his ticket and slay the beast that was administrative paper shuffling. The worst part was that one of his best friends, Dean, still had a year of team time left. Each captain got 2 years. And now Dean for sure was going to get into the fight, while Nelson would be wielding staplers and paperclips. Nelson wanted in, too. He spoke Russian. He'd recently been in Uzbekistan with Spencer and the rest of the team. He was itching for this. He paid a visit to Lieutenant Colonel Bowers' office. "Sir," he said, "I need to be back on my team." Bowers looked at him and said flatly, "No." Like the other men he had served with on the team, Nelson was stubborn and independent, and he had chafed under Bowers' command. He figured that his request was denied because the lieutenant colonel did not like him. In fact, when it came time to select the teams for the CSAR mission, Bowers had nominated another group of men in his battalion. Spencer's team had gotten the CSAR mission, only because other teams had recommended them so strongly to Colonel Mulholland. Bowers had grudgingly obliged. Feeling the urgency of the moment, Spencer and Master Sergeant Essex also appealed to Bowers on Nelson's behalf. "We really need him," they said. Bowers, either convinced or resigned, gave Nelson his job back. "You've got 6 hours to leave," Bowers told the two men. They had an airplane inbound that very minute to take them to K2, in Uzbekistan. Essex had no idea where Nelson was, and it was his job to make the trains run on time. He called Nelson on his cell phone, getting the voicemail. The young captain and his wife were in Nashville, at an obstetrician's office. His wife was expecting a baby in 2 months. And Nelson, an excited father-to-be, had turned the phone off before going into the appointment. "Hey, man," Essex yelled into the phone, "you need to get back here, like, right away." Essex was unsure of how to proceed over a non-secure phone line, so he said, "Because we're leaving now." He hoped like hell Nelson would make it back to the team room in time. He need not have worried. Several hours after it was ordered, the mission was canceled. There was no explanation for the change in plans, and there never would be. The team was ordered not to travel more than an hour's distance from the post. Deflated and dismayed, the men stood down. They could conquer any enemy but one, the men who pulled the levers at the Pentagon. For now, all they could do was wait. But not for long. On October 4, they got the call for real. The mission was on. As before, no explanation was given. Before they left, Major General Lambert flew down from Fort Bragg to address the crowd. digging into the pocket of his crisp camouflage pants. He removed a piece of jewelry. Most of the soldiers had only heard of this special item, the gold ring of war. A chipped ruby blinked back at them as Lambert held it aloft. "This ring has been through hell and back," said Lambert. "Worn on the hands of men who are dead or retired. Men whose work won't be talked about for years, if ever." Lambert knew the ring's history well. Back in 1989, as a young commanding officer, he'd asked one of his sergeants to take part in something called the Expert Infantryman's Badge Test. 5 days of running, shooting, and shitting in the woods. Lambert had asked the sergeant to take the test as a show of his leadership among the men under his command, and the man had passed, but just barely. Lambert, impressed that the sergeant hadn't quit, had given the guy his own expert infantryman's badge, which he'd had displayed in a frame on his office wall. Without pausing, the sergeant had taken off a ruby ring he was wearing and thrust it out to Lambert. "Here. We'll trade. This damn thing's been in Bolivia, Panama, Vietnam, Thailand, Pakistan, Belgian Congo, Bosnia, you name it," he said. Then he smiled. "Now it's yours." Lambert decided that henceforth the ring would be carried into battle or on a mission during each SF deployment. The only caveat was that the man chosen to wear the Ring of War had to bring it home safely. It was a bit of voodoo, military style. As he looked out at the conference room, Lambert remembered one man in particular who had worn the ring 5 years earlier. The man had appeared to be in excellent health, but then, surprisingly, failed a routine physical fitness test. Within a week, doctors diagnosed him with Lou Gehrig's disease. Within days, he couldn't even use his hands. Lambert had arranged for an immediate medical retirement, and his fellow soldiers painted the ringwearer's house, helped him sell it, and moved his family to a new city to be closer to relatives. The ring stayed behind. Several months later, Lambert received a phone call from the guy's wife. She had said he was depressed. "Is it okay if I put you on speakerphone?" she asked. Lambert, choked up, said, "Sure." He hadn't known what to say at first. He imagined his old friend sitting in his wheelchair, frozen, unable to move or speak. They taught you a lot in Special Forces, but nothing had prepared him for this. "You're a great man," Lambert had said, "and I admire you." His wife narrated her husband's reactions. "He's smiling," she said. "He seems happier." Lambert spoke for a bit longer. Then he hung up, thinking, "I'm going to fix this." He packaged up the ring and sent it to her. "Tell him to put this on," he wrote. "I want him to have it." But there was no returning from this mission. The man had put the ring on and sat in his wheelchair, and he stared at it, mute, trapped. When he died, he still had it on. His wife gave the ring back to Lambert, telling him, "He would want you to have this." Now, gazing at the men before him, Lambert asked them, "How will you die? I want you to think about that." It was not a rhetorical or even moral question. Part of each team's mission was to consider the ways in which it could be annihilated, in order to avoid such a fate. He handed the ring to the officer in charge of the meeting and said, "Give this to your best man. Make sure he brings it home." John Bolduc had come home from the pre-war planning trip to Uzbekistan on September 22, and Sharon, his wife of 17 years, and his teenage daughter Hannah, sat down together and talked about his retirement. Bolduc told Hannah that he felt they didn't know each other, and he said he was still hoping to change that. But now that chance would have to wait He was going away, he said, but he promised to come back. It was Balduk who was given the ruby ring. They went to the video store and rented some movies for his last night at home. Husband and wife laid on their bed, with Hannah between them, and stared at the screen. Sharon told him, "You know, I could just jump on your legs and break them, and you wouldn't have to go." She was only half kidding. Lying in bed, Marcia Spencer looked over and asked her husband if he was awake. Then she asked where he was going tomorrow. Could he tell her, she wondered. She already knew the answer. "You know I can't tell you that," said Spencer. In truth, Marcia didn't want to know any geographic specifics. All she really wanted to know was whether or not Cal would survive. Lying there, Cal next to her, Jake asleep in his room down the hall. It had been a good life, but still. She never said anything, not out loud, you couldn't. She burned at the lack of recognition. Nobody, and she meant nobody, knew exactly what dear Cal Spencer did when he went away on his missions. He came home sunburned, sand in his pants, ready to get back in the swing of family life, walking around with a screwdriver in his hand, looking for things to fix. My God, during their 20 years of marriage, he'd been absent for at least half of it. The sum never failed to stun her. 10 years of no Cal. She and the boys would get along, she knew that. They would grow old together, she and the boys, and Cal would be gone. But who would know what he had done with his life? The Army never let them say anything about their missions. When Cal came home, there was no welcoming party at some sunny airport with a brass band playing and the TV cameras rolling. What Cal Spencer did when he was away would forever be a mystery. What she and the boys endured remained hidden from everyone. In the past, Cal had had dreams of dying in the desert, some desert, any desert, but not tonight. He steered his mind to the sound of the crickets outside. They sang above the whir of air conditioners up and down the block. He figured that death was out there, a black dot on the horizon. Either you would pass it by or not. Until that time, there was little use worrying. He tried not to think about being killed, but he had the feeling that if it was going to happen, it would happen with this deployment. He had read enough intel to know how the Taliban treated their prisoners. The biggest thing was not to get captured. He'd decided he would not be taken alive. Cal Spencer fell asleep, knowing he might never again sleep in his own bed. The following day, Marcia dropped him off at 5th Group headquarters. Cal leaned in the car window and looked at her. "I love you," he said, "and I'll be back." He smiled. "Okay." Marcia was crying as she drove off. The parking lot was the scene of all kinds of turmoil. Ben Milo told his oldest teenage son, "You're the man of the house. You make sure you make things as easy as possible." The boy started sobbing. Lisa Diller drove away dry-eyed. She'd been cleaning the house the night before, and all day today, right up until it was time to drive Sam to headquarters. Whenever Sam deployed, Lisa cleaned. It was her way of dealing with the stress of her husband's leave-taking. Her way of saying goodbye. They had been through just about everything together. Sam had come home from the Battle of Mogadishu in Somalia in 1993. Dropped his duffel bag in the living room, and said shakily, "I'm home." Lisa took one look, and she could tell he was falling apart. She nursed him back, but at least he had returned. As she drove home now, her stoicism melted, and she broke down. Coming into the kitchen of the ranch house, She poured a beer and got into the hot tub and soaked in the thick new silence of the house. It was going to be a long, long winter. Late that night, October 5,